And unfortunately, Tom Murphy's testimony, you can't really understand it just by listening to the audio. But he gives a pretty detailed description saying that he saw the cops pull up, come out and said, keep moving. And Happy John, supposedly, according to Murphy, said, fuck off. And they shot him. But there was no indication he had any weapon in his hand. It was just a response by the officers to the comment. That was his testimony, at least in this video, as I saw it. Here's the end of this. My apologies for not having clearer audio here.
Was Happy John acting in an aggressive manner? Did he have a weapon that was being brandished? Did he point it at the police? And did he take a combat stance? All these claims were made by the district attorney's office and the police chief and reported in the media without much critical examination. And the claims were pretty much renewed in the final decision of the district attorney's office several days before this filming. What's the real truth? Well, we're still trying to get at it. For those who are interested in pursuing it, there is a body, the Citizens Police Review Board in Santa Cruz, which so far has declined to meet and consider the issue. There is the City Council, which so far has said nothing about this issue. There's a possibility of appointing an independent investigator and going to another district attorney in another county, or possibly convening a grand jury. But none of this will happen without citizen pressure and concern. In the meantime, a citizens group called the Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure is pressing on to investigate the matter. And the matter lies in the hands of you, the people. What happened that Wednesday night? I want to thank you for joining us, and please tune to Club Cruise Tuesday night, 7 to 7:30 p.m. Thank you.
And there was a considerable amount of petitioning and anger and public letter writing around the issue. The mayor at that time, Celia Scott, actually, in an unprecedented move, had the district attorney's report released to the public library. Apparently, I don't know if it was over the objections of then police chief Steve Belcher, but it's never been done since after any other shooting. And there were a number that happened after the Happy John Dine shooting of November 1997. The Citizens Police Review Board at that time refused to hold hearings on the issue, refused to hire an independent investigator, refused to subpoena the police officers, and eventually, when they reviewed the complaints that were made against the police officers, they found they were essentially without merit. I'm not quite sure the actual disposition. There are four different dispositions for these kinds of complaints. Unfounded, exonerated, unsustained, and sustained. Sustained is the only thing that means anything. It means the cop is engaging in bad or behavior that's against public policy or against police department procedure, if not against the law. You should think that a murder is against the law, but not if it's done by a guy in uniform, generally speaking. So next up is another show on Club Cruise, which featured stuff around the Sleeping Ban Initiative. Three individuals discussed it. Becky Johnson, I think, hosted the show. Linda LeMaster, who was either at that time or soon thereafter on the chair of the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women, the City Council's Commission. And Laura Tucker, with her small babe in arms, who's now grown to full manhood since then. Three of them talking about an initiative which they and others were struggling, myself among them, to put on the ballot to amend the sleeping ban to make it legal to sleep in some places in the city. Here is a bit of that. And this show happened January 8th, 1998. Thank you.
Hi, welcome to Club Cruise. I'm your host, Becky Johnson, and on tonight's show, we're going to be discussing a citywide citizens' initiative to repeal the sleeping ban here in Santa Cruz. We had invited my fellow proponent, David Silva, to be on our show this evening, but he could not attend due to illness. We wish him a speedy recovery. So tonight on our Club Cruise, we have two guests. To my immediate right is Linda LeMaster. She's the chair of the Commission for Prevention of Violence Against Women, a member of Housing Now, Housing Now Santa Cruz, a former city council candidate, a member of the Women's Economic Agenda Project, a SCAN member, and a founding board member of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. Linda, who is a single mother of three children, has been homeless herself for more than one occasion, and she participated in the City Hall sleepers protest, was ticketed under the sleeping ban, and has long advocated an end to the sleeping ban and the blanket ban. Welcome to Club Cruise, Linda.
Thank you, Becky. Hi.
And then also with my on the
she's on the warm-up.
Laura Tucker, a formerly homeless woman and a new mother, and she's here with her son Gabriel, who was born on October 17th. She is on the board of directors of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless as their homeless representative, a board that I also have, that I'm also on the board of. And she's the point person for the California Civil Rights Action Network, longtime residents of Santa Cruz. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thank you.
Hi. So today we're going to be talking about the sleeping ban here in Santa Cruz. When people talk about the sleeping ban or the camping ban, what do they mean? Let's look at that current law. So, Linda, could you tell us what about the current law?
Well, the existing law was first established in 1978. It's been through a few changes. Most of the changes have made it more restrictive, at least from the point of view of the homeless person getting chased around or ticketed and waked up when they're trying to sleep. You can get a misdemeanor if you get the ticket, that kind of ticket, more than once. It's probably going to cost you $162 if you have money and you try to defend yourself in the legal system.
So we're looking at that law now, and that's section 6.36.010 of the Municipal Code. And section A of that outlaws sleeping. Is that correct?
Yeah, it makes it illegal to be found asleep, and so the policeman who finds you has to make that judgment call whether you're asleep or just resting, and or covered up with blankets,
which is also illegal.
Right. If you are seen to be doing either of those things, actually being asleep or covered
at night,
then you can get a ticket. Often you get a warning the first time. Often, in fact, the police kind of brusquely, from my experience and what people have told me, you get shooed away. And depending on how you respond to that, it's kind of really a subjective judgment call by the policeman.
Mm-hmm. Now, Laura, have you ever been ticketed under the camping ban law?
I haven't been ticketed myself, although I have heard accounts from other friends who have been ticketed, and one of the difficulties about getting a ticket is that even if you do want to move or have an opportunity to thrive better in other places, you can't leave town until you've dealt with this $162 ticket, which if you're homeless, obviously you can't afford to pay $162.
Mm-hmm. And it goes up if you neglect to deal with it in the system by becoming a warrant, sometimes in as little as 2 weeks. So you can be stopped and put in jail immediately if you haven't been able to either pay or perform community service, which requires money, to do also.
Well, and community service is also quite an imposition when you're looking for work or housing and trying to survive. It's difficult to work for. Yeah. For
now, do you have to actually pay $25 to register with the?
That's a good point.
Community service program in order for the privilege of working for nothing.
I believe it is starts at $20. It depends on the amount of the ticket.
And then so $162 ticket would be
maybe $40. I'm not sure. It goes in increments. I believe from 20 to 40, and I'm not sure if that's. Exactly.
But it's a
correct.
Substantial amount of money for a homeless person to
and
come up.
And that's just to do community service.
And so for one act of sleeping, how many hours of community service would a person typically have to work?
Well, they say at the courthouse that your work is valued at about $5 an hour, give or take how much attention the judge is paying. The ticket that I got a year and a half ago, I was supposed to have to work 16 hours, so... kind of depends on the mood
now
of the judge,
I heard that it was actually paid at the rate of $3.33. Not that you actually get any money. you work and then you get credit for less than, well below minimum wage.
Right.
I'd like to meet somebody where it washes out to less than minimum wage because that also is constitutionally illegal and that's just been determined recently.
So, do people really go to jail for the acts of sleeping or covering up with blankets?
Oh, yeah, I know of people. I know a young man who had just turned 18. He'd been living with his father and mother and younger sister over near Pioneer House, which provides services to homeless people and people with drug addiction problems. It's like a place to be in the daytime. Mm-hmm. This young man... He had to serve 14 days in jail for some tickets that he'd only had a couple months to have gotten because he was homeless. And he didn't have the money to get into the system to work instead of pay.
So he did 14 days in
14
jail
days
for
in
sleeping?
Jail. Yes.
Also, I think what people do is they'll save up their jail time for the winter when it's raining so that they'll have a place to be, food and shelter.
So and the jails are overcrowded, incidentally.
Okay, so this law was passed in 1978. Do you know the reasons why this law came into being here in Santa Cruz? And have those reasons changed over the years?
I think the reasons have, in a sense, gotten entrenched over the years. As I remember, I do remember when we didn't have that law in the books, Becky, and it seemed to me that because people who had been chased around, who ultimately became a community and banded together and tried to defend themselves in court, that's the Scotts Creek Bluff community, part of both the city and the county's subsequent concern about having a law was a result of some homeless people finding out they might have the same civil rights that the rest of us have and not backing down but asking for their right to a trial and winning a few cases out of the whole onslaught. This was about the same time that the police in the city of Santa Cruz were indicted for harassing and even murdering homeless people. Harassing homeless people. Murdering a homeless person, I should say. So from my point of view, it was the city's attempt to kind of keep a tourism gentry environment or looking environment. This is before they put the extra tax on
hotels. You
think
that was the reason that they did initially?
Initially,
and
yes.
You think that it's different now? The reasons why the state city council is so adamant that they keep this law intact?
I think those reasons are still there, and they're constantly oiled or reinforced, so to speak, by the merchants, the interests of the downtown business community. I think the city is always having... The council members are being pressured by merchants downtown with this sort of kick the dog scapegoat mentality. They're convinced, some that I've talked to are absolutely convinced that the reason they're not having as many sales as they want to have is because there's people that aren't aesthetically appealing outside their businesses or somewhere on the block. Even as far as a block away, one of the merchants said, He thought people wouldn't come here to our downtown. Of course, that's not true.
I think it's a myth, too, just from having grown up in Carmel Valley and Monterey. And I know my friends and I, as teenagers, used to come to Santa Cruz because of the atmosphere. And I think that Santa Cruz is known for a little bit more of a colorful community. And so I wonder why they're not as concerned about the big mega stores that are they're going in. Costco, I think, took a lot of business from downtown. And I think that's a lot bigger concern than...
So you think the sleeping ban is really kept in place to discourage homeless people from staying in town?
The thing that bothers me about that is that I think that that's true in a lot of towns. And so where are homeless people to go? Being just recently homeless, and the rents are high enough that I think we're all afraid, you know. Donna was on just recently. I saw her on community TV about the Tenants' Rights Union and
with
people
Donna
being
Dice.
Donna
mm-hmm.
Dice being evicted. So
that rents have gone up 30% in the last 2 years.
Right, and so you get this feeling like there's just no your existence is not okay. There's nowhere mm-hmm. for you to be, and if it's illegal for you to just fall asleep, that you have to stay awake. Which is a form of torture, by the way.
Yeah. Sleep deprivation.
Right. So I think it's just absurd that people that are down and out and don't have, there's not enough resources for them to get it back together again. Mm-hmm. And also something I think people don't like to talk too much about is traveling lifestyle that some people do quite well. When I was living out in Big Sur, I knew several people that were living out on state land and not polluting and keeping things clean, and they'd travel around all the way from...
And sleeping in their vehicles often?
Or just camping, living mm-hmm. out of a backpack.
Uh-huh.
And they're clean people and they're intelligent people, and it's okay with me that they do that. I don't see that they're hurting anybody. Mm-hmm. But that's not a lifestyle that's encouraged in this day and age in society.
Okay, now we've heard at City Council meetings, Council Member Scott Kennedy has said that only 3 or 4 tickets are issued a month. Do you think that's accurate?
I think it's about as accurate as the things council members initially said about blankets being confiscated from the protesters that were sleeping at City Hall. Somebody may have said that, or maybe they made it up off the top of their head, but it doesn't pan out.
And that was when they said that only 2 blankets had been
right,
confiscated.
And then a dozen. And then, oh my gosh, more than 100 blankets. And I never did mm-hmm. see mine, so they're still not giving you the whole figure.
Uh-huh.
Similarly, I think that the number of people getting tickets, it's a little bit variable according to, let's say, political pressures, either neighborhood, residential,
mm-hmm.
The police claim they have a ticket on complaint policy in the residential neighborhoods. I've seen evidence otherwise, but that's their position.
Okay, now you mentioned this protest at City Hall, the City Hall sleepers protest. But have sleeping ban opponents really attempted to persuade City Council to repeal or modify this ban? And what's happened?
I think since before it was passed, there's been a strong and recurring, if not continual, large part of the population that has asked for it either to be repealed or to be humanized or in some way to be decriminalized. Mm-hmm. We've gone in asking for a simple moratorium until people can get their facts straight or mm-hmm. until it stops freezing. There have been a lot of different methods from appealing to them. This goes back to the late 70s. And it continues to this day, appealing to them during the oral communications, where it seems to be the only time the city will hear from the citizenry other than regarding something explicitly on their agenda.
They have been reluctant to schedule it as a regular agenda item.
Right. Until the past 4 years, in my view, in my recollection, they absolutely refused to hear anything. And they made a point of not responding. And It changed a little when Don Lane and Catherine Byers and later Celia Scott got involved on the council, so that there was some listening going on and a little more digging into the kind of figures, like we were talking about the blankets being confiscated from people.
Well, let's see what some different people have to say about the sleeping ban. We have a short clip which you'd like to show, which where I ask several people what they think of the sleeping ban. Let's see that clip now. And you're a homeless person?
I've been homeless for a long time in Santa Cruz County.
Have you ever been ticketed under the sleeping ban?
I've had quite a few sleeping tickets. Yeah. I've had a lot of sleeping tickets. I've been beat up by the cops for sleeping.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sleep at night.
I think the policemen are making it hassle to people for sleeping out.
If you sleep in your vehicle or outside at night, it's illegal.
They still get caught in their vehicles, just in regardless.
The law makes it so that the police can ticket people for sleeping. What do you think of that?
I don't like it. Uh-huh. It's not good, though.
Thank you.
I don't know.
Did you know it was illegal to sleep at night?
No.
Or it's also illegal to cover up with blankets at night. What do you think of that?
I don't know.
Well, I really personally don't agree with it, because if a person wants to sleep in his car, shouldn't have to worry about the police chasing out of town, as long as it's not causing any trouble to the community and taxpayers in general.
Thanks.
So as far as I'm concerned, sleeping ban, you know, I don't agree with it.
Okay, and so that was some various opinions on the sleeping bans. We had that one young woman, she didn't even know that there is such a thing as a sleeping ban. Is that typical?
I think there are plenty of people that the first time they find out is when the policeman rattles your car. You almost have to become politicized one way or another to know that this irrational law is part of the standard operating procedure of the city police. Other places that have that kind of regulation aren't quite as mean about it, like covering up camping, for example.
Now the two of you and David Silva, who I mentioned earlier, and probably about 100 other people, myself included, all started working on this initiative in August. So what are some of the reasons that this committee has come together to write this initiative? And could the two of you share some of the reasons for this?
Yeah, well, I guess speaking for myself, It seemed that we're not getting anywhere going through channels, whether it be the city attorney, the city council, or any of their bureaucracies and departments, and that taking this problem directly to voters and citizens in general might end up with a more humane result. I mean, it's bound to.
Well, and as I understand it, the citizens of Santa Cruz have never had a chance to vote on this. And so we don't really know how the general populace feels about it being illegal to cover up with a blanket after a certain time, or illegal to fall asleep when you have nowhere else to go. And so that's one reason, is that maybe people will think it's as absurd as we do. Also that it's, I think, violates the spirit of the Constitution. I'm tempted to just refer to our purpose, our statement of purpose and findings.
Yeah, this is
which says it more clearly.
This is a statement of purpose and findings, and this is a series of reasons that the committee put together for why this is so needed.
I could just read a couple of...
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Say, sleeping is an activity essential to human life, and sleeping at night is essential to being able to work and function normally during the day. Sleep deprivation is a form of torture, causing both physical and psychological harm. It causes fatigue, psychological impairment, hallucinations, memory loss, inability to concentrate, disturbed motor skills, lethargy, depression, and can lead to psychosis. They've done studies on people that weren't able to sleep or dream. It prompts substance abuse, and it's been proven that people, once they do become homeless, tend to abuse substances more than they did before they became homeless.
And that could be from sleep deprivation, some medication for the unpleasant effects of sleep deprivation.
That's one reason.
As a factor.
To put another slant on that, they tend to have to self-medicate more often because they're on foot, they have no money, they're reduced to very nothing but the moment. Mm-hmm. And right. They don't have the resources that a middle-class person has, like doctors and nurses. And
I think the other thing we should probably mention is shelter space.
That's
what is the relationship of shelter space to the number of homeless people?
A joke. The relationship is like there's a bed or what passes for a bed, a revolving mat through the church system. I would say for about one person out of almost every 100 in the city and county, in our Santa Cruz county.
And it's very difficult. I've tried to get into the shelter when I was homeless, and did stay at the Intersatellite Shelter Program, which is a program where people are able to go from different churches put them up each night. Anyhow, you're sleeping on a linoleum floor with the mat that's about this thin. I have sciatica, which is a lower back problem. I know a lot of people that are homeless have troubles like that. A lot of them are disabled, is why they have trouble. And if you drink alcohol, they won't let you in. So anybody that is an alcoholic or has any drinking problems can't get in. So it's a very uncomfortable night's sleep anyhow.
But the point is that the sleeping ban, it makes it illegal for those to sleep who can't even get into these programs, which are not even that desirable.
And they're hard. You have to wait in line. A lot of being homeless, if you want to do the program, as far as people say, well, there's food available, there's shelter available, you're waiting in line all day long, either for food or for shelter.
Yeah. Let's talk about the initiative itself. How will that change the law?
I think that if people see the old law and the fact that just being caught asleep anywhere in the city limits is a crime, and that happening to you more than once can put you in jail very quickly if you have no money, and they see that we can still have a camping ban and the city council can still
regulate the camping ban things. It'll still be illegal to camp if this initiative qualifies for the ballot and is passed by the voters in the November election.
And even sleeping, the city council will be able to regulate certain residential areas, beach areas,
commercial beach areas, oceanfront recreational.
Yeah. And
so that'll leave about, 40% of the city where people could sleep in their vehicles or... as long as you're not trespassing.
And also in church parking lots.
Right. That's already currently there. And what about the misdemeanor provision? You know, the misdemeanor, which under the current law, if you are ticketed twice within 48 hours, you are charged with a misdemeanor, punishable by 6 months in jail up to a $1,000 fine. So this initiative will...
Well, for sleeping, it'll just eliminate the misdemeanor happening.
And for camping, you'll be given a warning and 10 minutes to move. Mm-hmm. And then we'll be given a misdemeanor mm-hmm. if you haven't moved within 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. So
folks, if you see this, if the proponents of this law are bringing out the petitions and asking you to sign the initiative to repeal the sleeping ban, and if you're a registered voter in the city of Santa Cruz, please consider signing that initiative.
I think if people think about what it costs to criminalize people for just sleeping, it costs the taxpayer as well as that person. They'll want something that's a little simpler too, voters.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you both, Linda LeMaster and Laura Tucker, for being on Club Cruise.
Thank you.
And for...
And register to vote, people, if you're listening.
For a variety of reasons, in 1998, the Sleeping Ban Initiative did not get on the ballot. A lot of it had to do with weather-related conditions, the difficulties of petitioning. It was quite impressive to me that the Rent Control Initiative did so well, but they had powerful, well-organized, not particularly well-funded, but certainly well-motivated petitioners out there, the rent control folks did. The Sleeping Ban Initiative was followed by a second initiative attempt, which also failed to get enough signatures to get on the ballot. Then in the decade that followed, there were attempts to sue the city on behalf of homeless people as a class, claiming that the sleeping ban was a violation of various constitutional provisions of the federal government: cruel and unusual punishment, violation of due process of law, equal treatment under the law, and several other provisions. That initially received some support from the National Law Center for Homelessness and Poverty, but they dropped away from that, and the pro bono attorneys who were trying to help really developed other priorities, as did the activists grew. I was one of those activists, impatient with the attorneys who were essentially continually postponing activity. The current situation for the sleeping ban is unclear. It is still on the books. It has not been ruled unconstitutional by courts, but it hasn't been taken to higher courts here in the state or in the local area. It is currently, at least for the last year, under Police Chief Andy Mills. He has claimed he is not ticketing people at night who are not trespassing, or it's a little unclear. His statements, there seems to be a lessening of ticketing under the sleeping ban, but not really a lessening of hostile or overly controlling attention given to homeless people, and Parks and Rec rangers are continuing to essentially give people citations, and of course the new extra constitutional, which means unconstitutional to me, stay away orders without even a court process. It's all part of the same get them out of sight, drive them out of town mentality that's happened before, with the fig leaf of a 60 person campground and a so-called pathway to housing at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, and lots of talk about federal funding for housing or, I don't know, what, magnet programs. That's not the proper term, but programs that provide a lot of at least immediate temporary shelter and then ultimately put people into housing, which really doesn't exist, generally speaking, as you've heard Mike Zint talk about earlier in the show. Now I'm going to play for you something that, like this last Club Cruise that you heard with Linda LeMaster, Laura Tucker, and Becky Johnson on the Sleeping Ban Initiative of 1998, it has a lot of, to me, historical significance in the sense that it's one of the early efforts to protect tenants' rights. And we're going to be looking at listening to Becky Johnson interviewing tenants' rights activists Donna Dice and Marco Maricki. And Donna's still around. Marco died some years ago. And, of course, Donna's struggle has been taken up by somewhat more mainstream groups, encouraged to do that by activists like Zav Hirschman and Cynthia Berger, who have been pushing the envelope of the mainstream. Let's hear some of that. In fact, I will just allow it to play. I think this one is more audible. This was a from Club Cruise number 68 on January 19th, 1998. So we're talking more than 20 years ago. But the issues then really are the issues now. Although now we have an opportunity to vote on rent control, and I remind you there is a rent control kickoff party 4 to 6 today at 215 Garkey Street. That's the home of Ron Pomerantz and Jane Weed. Check it out. You can also find more information by going to the Santa Cruz Tenants Organizing Committee on Facebook, Santa Cruz Tenants Association, and like groups.
Hi. Hi, welcome to Club Cruise. I'm Becky Johnson. I'm your host this evening. And tonight we're going to be talking on a topic that concerns anyone in the greater Santa Cruz area who pays high rents or has high mortgage payments or perhaps is currently living in fear of becoming homeless. And tonight we have two guests with us from the Santa Cruz Tenants Union. And I think it's very fitting. We're taping this show on Martin Luther King's birthday. And I think it's fitting that we should be taping this show today because when Martin Luther King was assassinated, he was on the verge of starting the Poor People's Campaign. And that would greatly have affected housing and decent and affordable housing. And so tonight we have, to my immediate right, we have Marco Marocchi from the Tenants Rights Union of Santa Cruz. And then next to Marco is Donna Dice. And the two of you have been doing a great deal of work locally on this issue. So tell us about the Tenants Rights Union. What is it? Who belongs to it? And how long has it been in existence?
The Tenants Rights Union has been in existence for over 3 or 4 years at different and various levels of existence. Since April of 1997, Earth Day, we have been working an unlawful detainer project, which Donna directs and works mostly with. We have principles of unity. We're working on emergency eviction protections. We're a member of the Tenants Congress that is forming statewide, regionally, and nationally.
Did you first hear about this statewide Tenants Conference and then decide to form your local chapter, or did you form a local chapter and decide to hook up with a...
Well, actually, the Tenants Rights Union is a project of the Tenants Congress, which we developed here also, and we're actually initiating the formation of a regional tenants congress up in the Bay Area, and we're working with the San Francisco Tenants Union, Berkeley, Oakland, and other tenants union up there.
So what is the rental situation here in Santa Cruz? How affordable is housing, or how available is housing?
I think it's pretty well known that Santa Cruz has one of the highest rents in the country, certainly California, along with San Francisco. And we've seen that rent control doesn't necessarily help everyone. So that's why we're concentrating on the emergency eviction protections, which is just to make it more difficult and to create more mediation process before someone is put into the court system.
So rental deposits are very high to get into a place.
Rents sometimes $4,000, $5,000.
Rents have traditionally been very high in the Santa Cruz area, but I understand that there's been a major increase in rents in the last 2 years.
Part of it is due to Silicon Valley, the housing problem over there. I talked to Senator Scher in Palo Alto, who tried to pass a 60-day notice law to replace the 30-day notice.
and realized that a lot of people were commuting over the hill from here because they couldn't find decent housing over there because the rents there were going up hundreds of dollars a month.
So, so that's the problem. Santa Clara is spilling over into Santa Cruz County. But what role does real estate speculation play in the housing market? I'm talking about, people who will, say, purchase a property and then just sort of hang on to it until the cost, the property value goes up. Then they'll sell it without really investing anything in it. They'll just pull their chunk out, so to speak. And then that makes that unit much less affordable from then on. Do you find that to be a big factor here in Santa Cruz?
Yes, there's been a lot of tenants that have lived in their rental housing for 6 years, up to 16 years, and the owner hasn't done anything to improve the property, but they're giving them a 30-day notice without giving them a reason to move out. And the only thing they can figure is they want to jack the rent up $200 or $300 a month by doing some superficial repairs.
Well, let's talk about renters' rights and landlord rights. What rights do tenants have? And what rights do landlords have?
Tenants don't have many rights compared to the landlords. Landlords rule the courts. They rule the whole state legislature as far as laws go. Tenants do have a right to organize a tenants union without being evicted.
I understand you two have tested this one personally.
Donna has won twice. Uh-huh. One was an attempted retaliatory eviction and one was a retaliatory eviction. And she won both of them. Tenants have a right to repair and deduct upon giving notice to the landlord that that's their intention, that there's something wrong with the house that needs to be done. We've told you over and over again, so I'm giving you notice, I'm going to repair and deduct. Tenants have a right to do that. Tenants have a right to report their housing situation, the habitability, or the safety to any police agency or government agency or health agency without being retaliated against.
But they need proof.
They need some proof.
Yes.
But no, just the act of making a report to the city or the county or and having proof of that, sure. Yeah, everything a tenant does. In order for a tenant to really have rights, they have to maintain complete documentation. Without complete documentation, a judge will hardly hear their case at all. And so tenants and renters are urged to keep major documentation on everything, every little bit, every phone conversation, in order to prevail when there is a situation where it comes up to court. Mm. And that's how you maintain your rights, by maintaining really good documentation.
But most tenants really only have 30 days security at any point.
Right.
Is that true?
Right.
That's
unless
true.
They have a lease. Unfortunately, a lot of leases go from lease to month over a period of time, and so even people that pay under a lease can be liable.
And then the landlord can ask you to move out for
no reason.
No reason at all, basically.
Your 30-day notice with no reason given. That's
which is a pretty horrible thing for anybody to go through.
But we're trying to pass eviction protections that would bring up just cause for eviction, just like they have in L.A., San Francisco, Berkeley. We want to see just cause for eviction and not just a 30-day notice.
So that's something that you're working on in kind of a legislative solution would be these eviction prevention. How would that work?
Okay. State law allows the city and county and or county to legislate an ordinance regarding eviction. The city and or county can monitor or regulate the eviction process right up to the unlawful detainer, and I assume right after the unlawful detainer judgment is entered, monitor and regulate the writ of execution and the notice to vacate by the sheriff's department. And that's the scope of the eviction protection ordinance that we drafted up and we're presenting to the city council and the board of supervisors sometime early next month.
So you've drafted this legislation and you're hoping to entice city council or the board of supervisors to adopt it.
Yes.
And if they don't, would you consider putting forth an initiative to accomplish that?
I personally wouldn't. I just don't have the time or the energy to do that. I'm hoping that it's going to go legislatively. rent control has failed in the past here because mm-hmm. real estate has the Board of Realtors has a war chest of $100,000, I've been told, just in case the renters get uppity in Santa Cruz and want to get rent control. Mm-hmm. And eviction protections come under that same category. The Board of Realtors will not allow. Well, they're going to fight the emergency eviction protections that we're wanting and asking for, requesting.
So now this eviction protection, would that limit the reasons that a landlord could evict you?
Mm. Yes, they would. They would have to confer, have a...
I mean...
They would have to follow mm-hmm. just cause for eviction. They would have to, there's six or seven just causes for eviction, such as non-payment of rent, breach of contract, some others.
Uninhabitability.
Uninhabitability.
Retaliation, discrimination.
Right. Well, aren't those currently?
Well, some of those are. Mm-hmm. But non-payment of rent mm-hmm. And breach of contract, illegal activities. They've taken the rental out of the market. They're making mass rehabilitation of the place, or they're having someone move in, a part of the family own a move-in. Those are typical just causes for eviction. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have. You know, we've taken the just causes for eviction for Santa Monica, Berkeley, and San Francisco, and we've tightened them up some. We wanted to find, all of the, for instance, all of the other eviction protections and just causes for eviction allow for eviction for any illegal activity. Now, we don't want there to be any illegal activity because what about if someone's doing something that's a misdemeanor type of activity uh-huh. that's illegal, do they get evicted for it? Mm-hmm. So we're redefining any illegal and making it more specific as to felonious activity.
Not safe. Tearing a tag off a pillow that says "Do
right.
not remove,"
you know, or for instance,
or
if you have
frivolous.
Somebody sleeping in your backyard and sleeping uh-huh. outside is illegal, is a misdemeanor against the county ordinance.
Uh-huh. Well, not in the backyard, it wouldn't be, but
or something to that effect. Uh-huh. So we don't want people being evicted for misdemeanors, mm-hmm. just felonious activities, and being a nuisance. You can be evicted for being a nuisance. That's another one, and we would want to define what a nuisance mm-hmm. is.
Now, I understand that the Tenants' Rights mm-hmm. Union works a lot with unlawful detainers. And, Donna, I understand you go right down to the courthouse and look and see who's on the docket that day and has had an unlawful detainer filed against them. What are you doing with that?
Well, last April I started going down to the county courthouse every day, and there's a little 3x5 yellow form that you can fill out and look at any of the municipal court civil cases that are available now or in the past. So I've looked at the files, written down the addresses and any other pertinent information, and sent postcards to all those people. So it's over 400 people now that we've notified, sometimes ahead of time, of the sheriff that an unlawful detainer is coming, which people really appreciate. Because
so you've sent 400 postcards representing 400 unlawful detainers since mm-hmm. when?
Since last April.
So less than a year.
Mm-hmm. Less than a year. We estimate there'll be close to 600 this year.
600.
We average it out to 48 a month.
That seems like a really high number for this county. Is this...
It's proportional to everywhere else, San Francisco, Berkeley, L.A., even Nassau County. It's proportional.
For 1998. But is this unusual if we look back... few years, and is this...
In 1995 or 94, when I first initiated a prototype of the unlawful detainer program, I did it for 3 or 4 months, and it was somewhere around 40. Or 35, 40. So it's gone up 15 cases.
15-fold? Or tenfold or something?
No, there was 40 per month.
40 per month.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Or 35 per month. So it's been about the same, a little bit more. It's
gone, and that doesn't include everybody, because 8%. There's a lot of people that get a 3 or a 30-day notice and they just disappear.
I see. So an unlawful detainer is something beyond just a 30-day notice.
Those are the people that stayed beyond the 30 or the 3-day notice.
Right. The unlawful detainer is the actual... I want everybody to know out there that it takes an unlawful detainer to actually get a writ of execution to be illegally evicted. And you have to get an unlawful detainer before you're actually forced to move. A 30-day notice or a 3-day notice doesn't really do it. So a lot of people out there are forced out of their houses because of they get a 3-day notice or a 30-day notice, and they're scared, and they leave. They don't know that they have rights. They don't know that they can fight it. They can argue it. And so a lot of people are evicted with just a 30-day notice. And I'm estimating that there's twice as many people who get 30-day notices and leave. And that's mm-hmm. the eviction that happens. So we have 45 unlawfully detainers a month, then we have another 95 evictions a month, I'm estimating. That's a pretty close estimate. For every person who gets an unlawfully detainer and is evicted, there's two other people who get a 30-day notice or a 3-day notice and are evicted that way, or verbal threats. And now, with the emergency eviction protections, we can mandate that every landlord reports to the Eviction Protections Board every single 3-day notice, 30-day notice, and even verbal threat of eviction. Hmm. You see, because the city and the county have the right to regulate the whole eviction process, monitor and regulate the eviction procedures. Now that starts, as far as I know, the eviction process or the eviction procedure starts with the 30-day notice or the 3-day notice mm-hmm. and or the verbal threat. Like, I'm going to evict you if you don't straighten up, whatever the landlord says. That's the day the eviction begins. That's the day we should begin monitoring the evictions. We should get a report from the landlord that they made a statement like that, or that they put out a 3-day notice. And that will give us... when we do the unlawful detainer project now, we only have 5 days or 3 days to contact the tenants, mm-hmm. because the unlawful detainer process goes at such a super quick speed. It bypasses the ordinary civil due process of law. Everything else is 30 days, 30 days, 30 days. The unlawful detainer is 5 days, 5 days, 5 days. Hmm. It shortens the due process time and the timeline in court by sixfold. It takes precedence over every civil matter, and takes precedence over any criminal matter. This is to protect the landlord. This is what the California Board of Realtors have lobbied for over the last 30, 40 years.
Poor landlords need these extra protections.
And the California Apartment Association, they've lobbied for this unlawfully detained law, and they've got it, and it supersedes any civil action, any even criminal action. You go into court, and you'll see that they'll take the unlawful detainer case before they take the criminal case or any civil case.
Now, have you found a correlation between the number of unlawful detainers that are issued and homelessness?
Mm-hmm. I have. I calculate the last 10 years of unlawfully detainers comes out to something at 400 a year. That's 4,000. You take half of 4,000, and you get something close to the homeless population in Santa Cruz, which is close to 2,000, mm-hmm. thereabout. So, and I did it for San Francisco, and it came up the same. You take the last 10 years of unlawful detainers, the number you get. In San Francisco, it's 5,000 a year, so the last 10 years is 50,000, and they have a homeless population of over 25,000. So you take the the complete number of unlawfully detainers divided by half, that's the formula, and you get the homeless approximation of the homeless population.
As far as the people that we've helped personally, we help them through the process of filing the paperwork, and then we try to follow up with them and make sure that they found another place to live. But that's only in a few cases that they've actually got another place lined up. Most people end up staying with a friend or going to a motel or sleeping in their car. They don't have the ability to pay all the rent up to the day they move and have the money for a deposit for another place.
And a part of our principles of unity is that we're totally opposed to homelessness, and we believe that eviction has led to homelessness, and we want to abolish eviction, prevent eviction, slow it down, halt it, and hopefully by doing that we'll be preventing homelessness in the future.
Do you think housing is a right?
Oh, yes. That's part of our principles of unity. Also, we believe
you think there's constitutional support for that?
Well, there should be, or else why have a constitution if it doesn't allow... Why have a social contract if it doesn't allow for housing?
For instance, in the preamble to the Constitution, it says promote the general welfare.
Right, that would come under that, I think. We advocate and lobby for a constitutional amendment to guarantee housing for everyone. That's our stance. We won't veer from that at all.
Of course, at the time the Constitution was written, anybody could go out in the woods and build a little shack.
But first you had to commit armed robbery. To do that, yeah, you had to steal it from the Native Americans to do that.
Oh.
So.
Right. Okay, I'd forgotten that important point.
It is.
Let's see. Are there any good landlords?
Most landlords that I've heard are good, have one rental property, and they rent it to one person, and they don't have any problems. Mm-hmm. We have more problems with landlords that have multiple properties.
We have a couple of landlords who are somewhat good, and actually they want to be on our board of directors, and they want to work with us in some kind of way. And I'm not opposed to that, you know. Huh. I'm really not opposed to having... We even have one person who's a part of our group who is a landlord renter. For some odd reason, he rents, and he's also a landlord. So there are some good landlords, maybe a couple of few, but most landlords we've come across lie. They all lie. Mm. They all lie in the unlawful detainer process. They're all liars. I don't know if they're good people or bad people, but I know they're liars.
Mm. So I understand that you have something even more dramatic, a plan that's a rental rollback.
Mm-hmm. We are proposing to the Tenants Congress when it meets in February up in San Francisco. We'll be... other groups there, like the San Francisco Tenants Rights Tenants Union and Berkeley and Oakland, we're calling for a reduction of rents by 30%. We want to have a mass reduction of rents by 30%, and that's our program.
Why do you think? Where did you get this number 30%? Where did you come up?
This is
I mean, it
ironic.
Sounds good to me.
30% has always been. I went from 20% to 30%. Uh-huh. I started with 20% 5 years ago. Then it went up to 30%. And now we just find out that in San Francisco and the Bay Area, rents in the last 3 or 4 years have gone up 30%.
In the last 3 or 4 years?
Yes, they've gone up 30%. In the last year, they went up 15%. In 2 years previous, another 15%. So rents have gone up 30% in some areas in San Francisco and the Bay Area, between 25 and 30%. Rents have gone up that much. And so if we would have had a rent reduction 3 or 4 years ago, would be at a good place right now.
So let's roll back to 1994.
Let's roll it back to 1995.
Right,
that's
how
not very
bad
far.
Can that be?
Right.
I don't think we'll find too many landlords becoming homeless because of that.
In Santa Cruz, if there was a mass reduction of rents, if everybody participated, and I don't see why everybody wouldn't participate, it would liberate $16 million a month in Santa Cruz County. Now that's a lot of money.
Whoa.
And it would really help the local economy.
So how can we get in touch with the Tenants Rights Union of Santa Cruz? How can people get in touch with you?
Call us at 426-0644. And we have meetings on Monday nights at 7 p.m. And we have little get-togethers at our apartments. And you can call us if you want to have a get-together with us at 426-0644.
That's terrific. Thank you so much for...
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
We need help and volunteers. We want everybody to come to our meetings, and we appreciate your support.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Donna Dice. And now I have another guest here on Club Cruise tonight. It's Paul Valpini.
Valpino.
Valpino.
Yes.
Yes, and Paul is a brand new member of the Tenants Rights Union of Santa Cruz. Welcome to Club Cruise.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, I've heard that you've had kind of not the happiest story when it comes to housing in Santa Cruz.
At one time I did. I had a 2,000-square-foot home in Boulder Creek that I lost because of the interference of a neighbor who interfered with the property owner's property, and as a result, through threats and the such, I was asked to leave my property. So I didn't feel good about that, and I wanted to assert my tenant rights. So I brought a Superior Court lawsuit in Santa Cruz against the offending party, in which I charged third-party interference with the contract.
Mm-hmm.
My contract was with the owner, who was allowing me to live in the place, and in exchange, I was the caretaker. We got into conflict with the neighbor, which resulted in him threatening the owner of the property by burning his house down if I didn't leave. So, of course, the owner asked me to leave, and I didn't feel too good about myself after this occurred, and felt that the only creative way I had of asserting tenant rights was to bring a lawsuit, which I did. And just a few days ago, we had a jury trial in Superior Court on the lawsuit, in which I was asking approximately $200,000 in damages. I did the legal work research on it, and my wife actually presented the case to the jury.
So are they still considering this? Or
no, actually, at the trial level, we lost, and we're preparing for appellate levels next. But it's my feeling that everybody who has their tenant rights affected must pursue the process through the courts. And there's an awful lot of pursuits that can be taken.
Did you find that you didn't have enough rights as a tenant in your situation?
I found that they were a lot easier to assert for the landlord than they were for the tenant.
And so now what's your current situation?
Currently I'm living in my van, hoping to find a place or a living situation. Somewhat complicated because I also have a very large dog, which is an immediate negative, when, as anyone in this county knows, when applying for a home.
Now, have you looked around for other housing locally?
Yes, it's been very frustrating because, again,
the dog,
the
aforementioned dog, but
the rents are very high also, and often so many applicants come to a house, one feels like he's entered a lottery if you're even chosen in the process or even given any kind of preliminary consideration. So
yeah, I was house hunting myself earlier this in the end of last year, and we looked at one a three-bedroom house for $1,000 a month. 78 parties filled out applications for that one unit of housing. And
we really do need some radical change, and it's just not it's no picnic being a tenant these days with the escalating rents. And
so you think the tenants' rights union can collectively draw together the power of tenants to affect positive changes?
Hopefully there'll be a historic parallel with the labor unions, where enough people who are affected and they act in a block or in a class and do affect change. Otherwise, I think the tenants' abuses, the landlord abuses, will just continue ad infinitum.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for being on Club Cruise.
Thank you for having me. I hope you get
better situation going with your housing.
Well, it's a common story
here. And for you for your pooch as well.
Well,
dogs need houses, too.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, thanks. And watch us again Tuesday nights, 7 o'clock, and Saturdays at 9:30 p.m. Thanks.
Thank you.
And the final flashback is the Bathrobe Spears broadside show from December 1st, 2011, which happened in the closing days of the Occupy Santa Cruz movement. The first, first night after the takeover of the 75 River Street vacant bank building, which was leased by Wells Fargo but not used in the prior 3 years, and actually not used since until it was recently been remodeled and taken over. I'm not quite sure by what bank, but another bank has taken it over. The Occupy movement, of course, was a struggle against inequality, massive banker corruption, and the kind of fraud that has dispossessed all kinds of homeowners and produced lots of homeless people, for that matter. This is a show that actually featured Cracker, who was one of the occupiers who took over the building, the 75 River Street building. And there were numerous people interviewed from the first night of the 75 River Street occupation, and numerous people commenting on it, including Matthew Embry, who was still a listener at Free Radio. Hi, Matthew, if you're listening. And all, at that time, a broadcaster, as well as Linda LeMaster, who you actually heard in this prior broadcast from 20 years, well, 13 years before, since she was, you heard her from 1998, talking about the Sleeping Ban Initiative. And here in 2011, she discusses the occupation and other issues. That's it for this edition of Bathrob Spears Broadsides. A mixture of the topical and the historical. My apologies for bad sound quality. And also, because I had to put this show together late at night, not the kind of continuous commentary that I'd like to see myself provide for you, but unfortunately, my energy unfortunately has its limits, and there you have it. But hopefully you enjoyed it, and if you have any questions, if you'd like to be involved in Free Radio or involved in the aspect of the homeless civil rights movement that I'm involved in, which mostly these days is education and retrospective, though we still have biweekly meetings. If you want to be involved in Conscience in Action, come to the Wednesday meeting at 10:30 or 11 at the Sub Rosa Cafe at 703 Pacific. And the Huff meets the next week, Wednesday after next. Or if you're interested in helping but you don't like meetings, give me a call at 423-4833. That's the Huff line. Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Thanks for listening.